Mmm, the first taste of rare bourbon you finally got your hands on. That's nice. At Caskers.com, we make this experience easy. Caskers is a one-stop spirit curator with an impressive selection of exclusive, sought-after, rare, and household names in the realm of premium spirits and champagne. Discover the top flavors of the year now by going to Caskers.com and using code WELCOME10 for $10 off your first purchase. Get $10 off your first purchase with code WELCOME10 at Caskers.com.
You're listening to Atheistically Speaking.
Hello and welcome to episode 54 of Atheistically Speaking. I'm your host, Thomas Smith. Today, we've got the remainder of the interview with Ryan Bourne on the topic of free will. It's an awful lot, again, so I'm going to go ahead and just get right into it.
All right, so, yeah, clearly I'm just making up crap here, but with close call decisions where it's, maybe it's, like, really tight, maybe it's, like, do I go to Harvard or do I go to Yale, you know, maybe something like that.
Oh,
yeah,
I have to make that one every day.
Yeah, all the time. We've all made that choice. Harvard or Yale, which Ivy League will I go with? This is still as unrealistic as me not wanting to come on your show.
Oh, nice.
So this is tight, and we feel like, you know, when we're deciding that it really is open to us, this is the claim, that it really is kind of open to us to either go to Harvard or Yale. Of course, the truth of determinism is not, right? so we might think that there are sometimes decisions like that where it does feel like it's open. And it's certainly the case that we do not have introspective, right, internal conscious access to all that neural stuff that's going on. We do have a rather limited conscious picture of what goes into our decisions. And when we reach those sort of points of decision that could be close calls, there's a sense of openness there, right? And all of this could be indeed feeding into this concern about determinism. But all of this doesn't require actually some sort of metaphysical explanation, right? So when we're talking about determinism here, this is a metaphysical thesis. It can be understood as a logical thesis about entailment, but that's technical stuff I'm not going to get into. A straightforward understanding that you've introduced and is a fine one to work with here, it's often the one that's used as causal determinism, right? Where you've got laws, causal laws, you've got past events in a causal chain, and all of this takes and determines, it's entirely sufficient for all of our actions and choices and things like that. So that's metaphysical, right? But when I'm talking about the openness of this decision, will I go to Harvard, will I go to Yale? When I talk about a lack of awareness of all those neural events that come before when I flick my wrist or whatever was going on in the Libet experiment, right? This is not a metaphysical problem. This is epistemological, right? Perhaps the reason that close calls feel like close calls to us, well, it seems really open that we'll either go to Harvard or Yale, is not because it's causally open to us, right, metaphysically open to us, but rather it's epistemically open. We, right, while a Laplacian demon might know, or the supercomputer, right, in Namias experiment might know what's going to happen, we don't know. And that epistemic openness could be what explains an experience of openness that libertarians think is like metaphysical, but is really not. And likewise, that lack of awareness of all those neural events that precede our decisions. You know, perhaps this has been taken to mean that all that stuff that came before didn't matter, you know, in a metaphysical sense. That is, we could take and break free from that chain of causes in the Chisholm sort of agent causation prime mover sort of stuff. Or it could just be, again, an epistemological thing. What explains the apparent insufficiency of these past things, events and laws of nature is again, it's just an epistemic thing. It's just a lack of knowledge of what's going to come after, and a lack of knowledge of all that stuff that came before. What happens is you have, like with Harris, right, to bring it back to, you know, a specific person here in the debate now, Harris seems to think that because we don't know, like to go backward looking here instead of forward looking with a close call decision, because we don't know all that stuff that came before, and we are unaware of all that stuff that takes and contributes to those choices and decisions, that somehow that's like a threat to free will. Well, that's only if we actually give a crap about whether we know. Right? We can have the feeling of openness, the feeling that maybe the past stuff doesn't matter. But this feeling may just be, again, a feeling of ignorance. And that's very different from a feeling of ultimate responsibility and prime mover contra-causal freedom that incompatibilists think that most ordinary people believe they have. So most ordinary people can have these sort of experiences, as I'm describing. But the explanation for it, right, the feel of it here may not be a metaphysical openness or a metaphysical ultimate responsibility, but rather just an epistemological openness. The feel or the experience comes from ignorance, not I'm like an awesome godlike power who can take and initiate entirely new chains of events in the universe, right? So that's my response to the, well, what about all the decades of people disagreeing about this? Now, the other thing that you brought up with Dennett saying, well, who gives a crap, right? If people think that free will is this way, why should we listen to the folk, right? As
well, not exactly. I mean, I think he's saying that, you know, it's not fair for Harris to criticize a view that he doesn't hold and to say, you know, that sort of thing. I think it's relevant, but I think that, so that just, you know, that I don't think that okay. was quite what I said, but.
All right. Okay. Yeah. Sorry.
No, it's okay.
You know, if when I start using the mild profanity like crap, you know, I'm getting a little loose in the way I'm
sure,
talking about
sure.
stuff, right? And you come in, you tighten it up. So let's tighten it up here. Let's use some terms that Dennett. He talks about a revisionist understanding of free will, right? So you can, on the one hand, say that we're going to take and preserve what ordinary people think about free will. And, you know, if it turned out that ordinary, everyday people think that we do have contra-causal libertarian free will. If you reject this notion of revision, if you say we need to preserve everyday people's sort of intuitions, then we might, you know, end up taking the view that, well, yeah, we don't have that, right? In the same way that an atheist would say that, yeah, ordinary everyday people think that there's some, you know, fairy in the sky. Well, guess what? There's not.
Yeah.
You know, we don't take and try to redefine God or something like that. We just reject it as nonsense. And if it turns out that everyday folk think that we had some, you know, super awesome power like that, that's, you know, basically like impossible and outside of the natural order on one conception, we'd say, yeah, no, we just don't have that, right? For Dennett, his approach to revisionism is one, I don't think that he believes that people are natural incompatibilists. Dennett, I believe, is sympathetic to the sort of work that Namias is doing that suggests that people aren't natural incompatibilists. He's not saying that they're necessarily compatibilists, but he's saying that there's not this intuition present among ordinary everyday people in favor of the incompatibilist view. So Dennett is sympathetic to the work that Namias is doing. But Dennett also seems to take the view that, hey, look, you know, ordinary everyday people's views about free will and other philosophical topics can be a little bit confused. They can be, you know, something that needs refinement. And that's what philosophers do. We take these concepts and we reflect on them. We try to refine them and hone them so that we come up with something that's better. It can't be a radical revision if we're going to preserve something of what ordinary everyday people think. But we might have to do a little bit of tweaking. And the example of philosophical revisionism that Dennett gave was saying, think about people's ordinary everyday views of the mind, right? He thinks that people have sort of messy intuitions about this, but we take and we tidy this up. In particular, our everyday sort of folk psychology that we use to explain our own and other people's behavior, right, allows us to sort of function socially and stuff like that, make sense of what we do and what other people do and are going to do. He says, we take and we clean this up with scientific psychology. That's not an eliminativist project, right? By revising it, we don't eliminate the mind. We just take and come up with a cleaner, tidier conception of it through some scientific and philosophical work. And he thinks that, well, maybe that's what we'll need to do with people's everyday ordinary conception of free will, too. We'll need to take and tidy it up a little bit, just like scientific psychology took and tidied up our understanding of the mind. So that's something that's open to us. And then Harris is like, no. Right? He sees this, I believe, more on par with people's, you know, if they have such a view, people's everyday ordinary conception of God as some sort of fairy in the sky with magical powers, right? He's like, yeah, that's what people think, and people are wrong. And that's basically the end of the story. We're not going to tidy up their conception of God and make it scientifically respectable or something like that. But Dennett, on the other hand, thinks that free will is like our everyday conception of the mind, right? We're going to take and tidy it up a little bit. If it turns out that everyday ordinary people are dualists, right? They think that the mind is some sort of what did Patricia Churchland say? Like an ectoplasmic mind whiffle. She had just some really like cutting description of it. It was hilarious. If that's what people think, it's like some ectoplasmic whiffly ghost stuff. Then yeah, we're going to throw that out just like the fairy in the sky, right? There's no making dualism scientifically respectable. And there's no making contra-causal free will, as a libertarian would propose it, or an incompatibilist says we don't have it. There's no making that scientifically respectable either. But if it's not that far out, you know, maybe it is something we could tidy up, as Dennett is saying.
Okay.
But bottom line, we need to take and motivate, because it seems you might still be skeptical about this. We need to motivate an interest in what ordinary everyday people think about free will.
I didn't mean to say I'm not. I agree that we should. I think someone who's better at it than I, or maybe I need to do a lot more thinking to come up with a guess, would need to think of maybe a better way of phrasing the question. But what I wanted to say earlier is, I mean, all this is sort of assuming that Dennett's version of free will works, you know, and I don't know that. That's just something that everyone's going to take for granted. The way we've been talking about this here, it's sort of as though, well, is this the popular conception? If so, then, you know, they're wrong and it's terrible. If not, then we're fine. But, you know, I don't know that we're just fine if everyone's sort of naturally a compatibilist. I don't know that still means that Dennett has a coherent view of what free will is. So I'd be curious to hear a little more about like a precise definition of what compatibilists would say free will is.
Well, as I mentioned earlier, compatibilists would say that free will is a matter of exercising conscious capacities, reason responsive capacities, as Namias would call it. In fact, let me see if I can hit you with a quote, right? Because I told you that Harris had cited some of Namias's work in his book Free Will, and he had rejected things that Namias said as part of free will. He'd rejected those things as having nothing to do at all with free will. So here we go. I'm looking at Namias's review of Harris, and this is what Namias says about Harris. He says, Harris quotes my New York Times column describing free will in terms of having capacities for conscious deliberation, planning, and self-control, and having the opportunity to exercise these capacities in action. So there you have the things that Namias and Dennett and a number of other compatibilists would make central to free will: capacity, psychological capacities for conscious deliberation. So you're thinking, I should do this, maybe I shouldn't do that. Planning, right? What am I going to do next week? Am I going to exercise? Something like that. Self-control. Am I going to eat that candy bar? Am I going to hold back? All those things. Namias says these are the things that matter for free will, having the opportunity to exercise these capacities in action. It's not having some right incredible, miraculous, prime mover sort of power that Harris believes everyday people think they have. Harris responds to this, right? So Harris quotes the stuff about conscious deliberation, planning, self-control, opportunity to exercise these capacities. He quotes that from Namias. And Harris says, quote, these phenomena have nothing to do with free will. And Harris bases this position on his claim that he is, right, attacking the popular conception of free will. And he takes that popular conception of free will, again, to be incompatibilist. And the incompatibilist understanding of free will is very metaphysically demanding, right? It's a big, big hurdle to clear for free will if you say that determinism would falsify it, right? Because you are claiming that free will, right, for a will to be free on the incompatibilist view, it has to be able to break free essentially from the natural order, right? It has to be able to break free. Well, there is indeterminism in the natural order, so I shouldn't say that, right? It doesn't have to be supernatural. But it has to take and break free from past events and the laws of nature, right? And this could involve like some weird indeterminism stuff, but you know that Harris doesn't find that compelling as a basis for free will, and compatibilists also wouldn't think that indeterminism is a compelling basis for free will. So
what was that quote from? I kind of want to look into that a little more, maybe later.
Which quote? The Harris quote or the Namias?
Yeah.
The Harris quote?
Yeah.
So the context, this is from Namias' review of Harris's book, Free Will. The context, Namias is saying that Harris quotes him in the book.
Oh, right? Okay.
Harris says, Eddie Namias, right?
This is Namias quoting Harris.
Yeah, it's deep inception stuff here, man.
Okay, so that's why Harris, time's going so slowly. No, I'm
right.
So yeah, okay. I just want to look a little more into that. That's very, very interesting.
Harris pointing to the stuff that compatibilists like Namias would say matter for free will. Harris says those things have nothing to do with free will.
So is Harris saying
deliberation, planning, self-control? Those things have nothing to do with free will because Harris believes free will is a contra-causal power, right? That allows us to break free from the causal order that's described.
Well, I've never heard him say that, so I'm trying to figure out where you're getting that. Are you getting that just as an analysis of what his view ends up being, like the fact that he? Are you just deriving, like, because determinism goes against Sam Harris's version of free will, therefore he believes in free will as contra-causal? Is that the logic?
Oh.
Because he never uses those terms.
I thought – let me pull up his –
But, I mean, well, it might be accurate. I'm not saying it's not. It's just I'm trying to reconcile kind of what I've read of him.
Okay, sure.
And is it that also he might say that the ability to have done otherwise, you know, when you're looking back at something, or is that sort of where you're getting that too? Like, you know, as Dennett would say, rewinding the tape, that seems to be where the question really squares off. Because Dennett would say, when you look back, when you rewind the tape on something, it doesn't tell you anything. You want to know what might someone do in a very similar circumstance. Because when you, under determinism, when you rewind the tape, the same thing happens every time. We all, you know, that's pretty much a given.
And, gotcha.
And I think Harris's view would be, or I'll just say a view of free will might be that you could, at that moment, you could have done something different.
Yeah.
And I think that people, ordinary people that I've talked to, I mean, I think they do have a problem sometimes, though I'm not saying they're 100% incompatibilist or anything. I'm just saying, I think people sometimes do have a problem with looking at that and thinking, they do feel like, okay, I could have done something different, when in reality they couldn't.
Yeah. Okay. So
in those exact circumstances.
Sure. There's two different ways that we could talk about the incompatibilist conception based on two different principles, right? So there's a principle alternative possibilities. That's one, right? We've been talking about that with having an open and future, right? I could really go to Yale or I could really go to Harvard. Mm-hmm. There's another way to think about determinism. And this is a principle of the transfer of non-responsibility, right? There are events, to speed this up, there are events prior to your birth for which you are not responsible. You have no control over those, right? Those events cause more events leading up to right now, right? But because, right, what happened now, the things that you're doing now, were caused by prior events which ultimately lead back to ones that you're not responsible for, that non-responsibility, right? It just sort of zips all the way up. You're not, to take it all the way back to the beginning of the universe, you are not responsible for the beginning of the universe. And your lack of responsibility for that event transfers the next link in the chain, to the next link in the chain, all the way up to the most current link in the chain, right? You deciding to do something right now. So that we don't even have to talk about alternative possibilities for that transfer, that principle, the transfer of non-responsibility. The alternative possibilities thing, again, you've made an appeal here to our experience of free will. And my suggestion was that it's not so much a metaphysical openness that our experience is tracking as it is an epistemological openness. It's an ignorance about what the future will be, not the future is radically open in a way that we are right now going to determine it, past and laws of nature be damned.
Does that suggest that if we knew things then we wouldn't have free will? Is that what, like if
there's so with the so you come to the prediction thing, right? There is, you've set aside like neuro machines and stuff like that to scan your brains. Let's talk about God's foreknowledge. You know, one historical way to challenge free will is to say there is a God. This God is all powerful, all good, and guess what? All knowing, which means that God knows when you were going to be born and what you were going to do all throughout your life, right? And we might worry then, the same way that like somebody being able to predict everything that we do, the Laplacian demon, God being able to know everything that we do, that this kind of undermines free will. But that seems to come back then to the principle of alternative possibilities, right? Where we have what, again, to sort of motivate concern about alternative possibilities, it would appear to be the experience that we have, right? Is the experience the one that is tracking some concern about metaphysical openness? No. It may be one that's tracking epistemological openness. Now, I want to justify my attribution of a contra-causal notion of free will to Harris
sure.
by quoting from his response to Dennett, Right? There's a portion of his response to Dennett where he says that, here's where we disagree, Dan, right? Because they are buddies. It's as nasty as this exchange appeared to be in some points, right? They are good buddies. I guess, you know, atheism unites. So he says, I believe you, Dan, have changed the subject and are now ignoring the very phenomenon we should be talking about. The common felt sense that I, he, she, you could have done otherwise, generally known as libertarian or contracausal free will.
Oh, okay. I missed that word. I apologize. Right. I fixated on the could have done otherwise, I guess. So you're right.
So here we get into sort of complexity of the debate. Contracausal, that's where we might take this, you know, agent causation sort of understanding of it. But could have done otherwise still is something that's intended to be contrary to, incompatible with determinism.
Yeah. Right?
The thesis of determinism here is that past events and the laws of nature are sufficient, right, to cause present and future events. Another way to put it is that given past events and the laws of nature, at your moment of choice, there's really only one thing that you can do. It's not as though I could go to Yale or I could have done otherwise and gone to Harvard. No, you could, whatever you ended up doing, that's what you could do. End of story.
Right.
And there are different ways to think of you could have done otherwise. Compatibilists historically proposed what's called a conditional analysis. They said, yeah, you know, when we're talking about could have done otherwise, it's not in that strong sense of alternative possibilities where, despite the passing laws of nature, there really are two paths open to us, right? As though we can sort of break free from that chain, whether it's because we're prime movers or something or whatever, who knows, right? But compatibilists used to say that could have done otherwise actually has a different, more appropriate interpretation. It's not the radically open garden of forking paths sort of thing. Rather, it's just, were the past different, right, then yes, we could have done otherwise. This particular conditional understanding or interpretation of could have done otherwise, it's by many, it's not considered terribly compelling.
Yeah, I was just going to say.
You're like, well, of course.
Yeah.
Right? Of course, if the past had been different, right, then you could have done otherwise. But that seems, again, empty and unsatisfying. And in large part, the defensive compatibilism that you get nowadays, I don't think they really press this conditional sense of could have done otherwise. Instead, they say people aren't thinking in some conditional sense of this. Rather, they're just not concerned about alternative possibilities, right? Because this again, that's one of the principles. Principle of alternative possibilities, and the other is principle of non-transfer responsibility. Those are two important principles that incompatibilists take to define free will. And compatibilists would say, actually, neither of those principles are actually are involved in people's ordinary conception of free will. In other words,
really?
Ordinary everyday people would say, actually, it's totally okay if I couldn't do otherwise, right? In the sense that past and laws of nature fix, right? One particular present, right? One particular future. Like, no, that's okay. Or if you told them, hey, guess what? You're not ultimately responsible for what you do because there are past events for which you're non-responsible, and that lack of responsibility transfers into the present, right? And they say, well, yeah, I also don't give a crap about that, right? If we give a crap about, here I am using the word crap again. If we really care about what the folk think, if that's something that libertarians would use or incompatibilists would use to motivate their view, they're like, yeah, I know this sounds crazy, but guess what? This is what people think, and I'm going to tell you that we don't have it. Then we need to ask everyday ordinary individuals what they think. So,
well, can't we just talk about the possibilities? I'm tired of being worried about what everybody thinks.
Well, then you should tell philosophers to shut up about it, right? This would include Harris, who said this is the popular conception of free will. He's made it a part of his – well, you know, one objection to this. Are you familiar with the Bad Wizards podcast? You heard of this?
I don't think so. What's that?
All right. Maybe it's more something for philosophers, right? I brought it up just –
well, I'm very curious. I'm all for a podcast recommendation.
I know that Harris is aware of it. I've seen some mentions of it in his Twitter feed. So it's a philosopher.
I should let you know. I mean, I'm not really that obsessed with Harris. I follow him, but I follow Dennett just as much. I like him.
I know, and I at the start of the show, I'm like, this is not about Harris.
Yeah,
and then
but it just was an easy, relevant kind of debate that a lot of people read. Sure. So it's just it's natural that it kind of is falling into those views.
And let me, it's a point of familiarity for listeners, for the public. As I said last time I came on the show, I'm glad for figures like Harris, even if I think that their arguments could be better or something like that. I'm still glad we got people out there pushing those ideas. When it comes to the free will debate, his status as a neuroscientist, right, puts him right on up there with various other neuroscientists who are denying that we have free will.
Yeah,
it seems
to be pretty popular with neuroscientists.
So it's not like it's not like with the philosophical debate where you got academic philosophers who are like, shut up, you don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Right? Get out of here. No. The free will debate, neuroscientists, yes, they're talking about philosophy, and philosophers will still be like, you don't know what you're talking about. A majority of philosophers, it turns out, are compatibilists, and they find that the arguments the neuroscientists are making are compelling. But insofar as there's a movement here among scientists to say, yeah, guess what, we don't have free will. Yeah, Harris he's right up there. He's a ranking figure, right, given his credentials, his expertise in this particular area. And I believe that's why Namias is targeting Harris, along with the number of other scientists who were making these sorts of claims, including Wegener, right, who was writing about this stuff before Harris even published his first book, End of Faith. So
even before End of Faith. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Sorry, I thought you were talking about his free will book from a couple of years ago.
Oh, but yeah, no. Even before End of Faith, right? Oh,
okay.
Before his publishing career even began.
Yeah.
Right? Long. Yeah. That's you already had Wegener writing about this sort of stuff,
right?
And Namias addressing Wegener's views, and now addressing Harris's. That Harris.
Yeah, and certainly, like I mentioned,
gang.
When I learned as much or as little as I did about this the first time, it had nothing to do with either Dennett or Harris. So it's not.
Yeah.
It's fine to use that debate as kind of an example, but really we're just talking about compatibilists and incompatibilists, I think.
Sure.
And occasionally mentioning the kooky libertarian view of free will.
They are a kooky minority. I think it's like, talking to philosophers here, maybe 15% or something of philosophers are libertarians. Unsurprisingly, whether you're a libertarian tends to strongly correlate with whether you're a theist,
right?
And whether you believe in something outside the natural world.
That would be how, when I talk to my family about this, if I ever did, I haven't lately, but it's been fun to debate it sometimes. It seems very clear that they're starting with the answer that we have free will because God said so, and then trying to go from there. Let me ask you just to get back on. Sorry if I'm interrupting, but I'm curious about what did you call it? The transferability of responsibility, sort of.
Dude, it's a mouthful. The principle of the transfer of non-responsibility.
Transfer of non-responsibility. Yeah, that's interesting, and it's curious that. So you're saying that compatibilists say that doesn't matter. It's irrelevant to free will.
Yes, that is correct.
Okay, but. I think they would still need to talk about it because Dennett does talk about free will as moral responsibility, and we do still need responsibility. It's not like compatibilists are saying, oh, don't worry about responsibility, however we have free will. Mm. Right. They're saying we have free will and therefore we have some level of responsibility. So it seems like you would need to maybe have some answer for that still, wouldn't you?
Oh, yeah. No, you're right on it here. So we need to tidy this up a little bit. The principle of transfer of non-responsibility is not about moral responsibility necessarily. What it most assuredly undermines, and Dennett talks about this, is any notion of ultimate responsibility.
Right.
So incompatibilists tend to think that ultimate responsibility is required for free will. In order for you to be responsible for your choices right now, you have to be responsible for the events that led up to those choices, right? But then you would also have to be, right, responsible for the events that led up to those and so on and so forth all the way back to the Big Bang. Well, guess what? Anything before your life started, we can assuredly say you were not responsible for. So the transfer of non-responsibility is what deprives you of ultimate responsibility.
Okay.
Not what would deprive you of some weaker sense of responsibility that would make us morally blameworthy or praiseworthy, right? So that's... We haven't even talked about that, right? Free will and moral responsibility. Namias' work probes people's intuitions about both of those things, right? So we've got this hanging question here about why are we talking about people's everyday intuitions? And the answer that I've given so far is, well, philosophers are talking about them. They take it to be something that would motivate their view, in particular incompatibilists, who say, I know it sounds totally far out to define free will in this way, but that's what ordinary everyday people think that it is, and now we're going to prove that that doesn't exist. So it's not like the heart of the debate exactly, but people's everyday intuitions is something, again, that seems to set the burden of proof, or at the very least justify incompatibilists defining free will in such an incredibly demanding way. Right.
Okay, sure.
Another reason for us to care about everyday people's intuitions about this is if there were ever a subject where philosophy really brought it down to the everyday man, it would seem to be discussions of free will. You know, and when we're trying to sort out whether we have it, we wouldn't want philosophical, scientific, academic discussions of it to be radically removed from what's going on in the everyday.
Sure. And again, I didn't really mean it's completely irrelevant. It seems like we've come to the conclusion that experiments are being done to really get at what people's everyday conception is. There's some problems with those experiments, but you know, maybe not. I mean, maybe that does show that people tend to be more compatibilist. But basically, yeah. I just wanted to say, okay, let's take that as a given that we're not entirely sure. Let's just talk about the different possibilities. That's all I meant to say. Let's just discuss the different definitions and see which makes more sense to us.
That's the key, ma'am. Right. So you're saying let us take and sort of define and structure and lay out the conceptual space and go to work. Right. Mm-hmm. But when we go to work in this conceptual space here, when we start having the free will debate, right, we would be concerned, I imagine, about trying to arrive at the correct view. How would we arrive at that? Well, it seems that there are quite a few points at which we need to appeal to intuition. Right. And what's happened historically in the free will debate among philosophers is that you're at a stalemate. You've got libertarians and, other incompatibilists that are like, this is the intuitive, natural understanding of free will. And then you've got compatibilists that are like, no, that's not actually the natural or intuitive understanding of free will. And incompatibilists come back and say, you're just making up crap, right? Kant, Immanuel Kant, who was he's a libertarian, I believe, he said that compatibilism is a wretched subterfuge, right? and Harris, right, he says, here he comes again, Harris. Harris is telling Dennett, hey, you know, when you talk about compatibilism, you're changing the subject. These are like bold headings in, you know, organizing his response to Dennett. And of course, let's remember what he said to Namias. I was talking about self-control, conscious deliberation, and stuff like that. He's like, this has nothing to do with free will. Well, again, how do we know what's relevant to the discussion here? How do we take and define free will? It comes back and we appeal to intuitions. Well, whose? Well, you can ask philosophers, but their intuitions may be so deeply entrenched by their theoretical commitments that their intuitions don't really get us far. They just keep us in a stalemate. Well, they're not just, you know, talking about their own intuition, even though that's the only evidence that they have, right? They're saying that this is what ordinary, everyday people think, but they haven't actually investigated that question. And now, finally, after, you know, however long the debate's been going on, it's, you know, we really only had scientific psychology around for a short time here, so this is understandable. But we're doing the psychology now to figure out what do ordinary everyday people think about it, right? We can't really escape that question. Now, you might say, well, maybe we can. At least we can kind of talk about what's going on here without knowing what the folk think. Well, yeah, we can kind of structure the space. But when you say, you know, let's go to work and let's figure out what's right, it seems that, we can't escape these questions about ordinary everyday intuitions, and we wouldn't want to, because, again, we wouldn't want this discussion to be some sort of technical academic fiction that is removed from the everyday reality that all this begins with.
All right. Okay. I guess we have to talk. So I can't get out of it, huh? I can't get out of talking about the conception of free will. All right. Everybody's everyday kind. Okay, you've convinced me.
Oh, are you serious? Did I actually convince somebody of something? That is,
well, just that we need to worry about what everybody thinks of the definition of free will is.
It's a minor victory, but I'm going to take it. I like, as trained as I am.
All right, I'll give you a certificate. So you give me, we'll do a certificate exchange program here. You
send
give me
it
a
my
certificate
way.
saying I sometimes kind of know what I'm talking about. I'll give you one saying my mind was kind of changed on one minor point of a debate.
So no 20 grand, but I do get a sweet little certificate. Nice.
Yeah.
It's funny. When I teach critical thinking classes, we begin with a definition of argument. It's an attempt to convince, you know, and I'm always tempted to tell the joke, but you know, these are often failed. You know, so this is nice. I feel good about your show now. This was a successful attempt to convince.
Well, it's interesting. I still want to just pick a definition that I think is good because I don't think they're so wildly off that, you know, one or the other is just completely unusable.
They are contradictory, though. They're incompatible with one another. Yeah, we can't use them both. You can't say that free will is compatible with determinism, as a compatibilist would say, and at the same time say that free will is not.
No, I'm not saying we can. I'm just saying if I were to try to, based on everything we've talked about and based on kind of, you know, our firsthand experience, if we were to try to talk about what definition seems to be most appropriate, I doubt that it would be so outlandish as to be unusable to people.
We could pick one or the other. For sure, right? They're both
have we defined one of these? I mean, have we even sufficiently outlined them? I mean, so we've talked a bit about the compatibilist one. You've mentioned key factors, and is the key factor of the incompatibilist one just that it's contra-causal? Because that sounds, I don't know, that sounds weird to me. Or is it hard to define? Is that another problem of it? Because I find free will very difficult to define, but you're speaking as though we've easily outlined both definitions, so I'm probably missing something.
Well, we are leaving some stuff out, right?
We've at least left some, or you know, defined some constraints or something.
This is not necessarily a bad thing, but I mean, if you want to turn it into a recitation of the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy, there's about 10 different ways that we can understand free will on an incompatibilist.
Oh yeah, I think I read that very thing before my last episode. it's useful, that's for sure.
Yeah, so you know, we philosophers can slice things pretty fine.
Well, one thing I mentioned before too in my previous episodes is, when I was thinking about this, when I was taking some philosophy classes in college and stuff, and I thought a lot about it, though I was kind of coming from the view like, oh, maybe we don't have free will, or at least how we think about it or whatever. And then when I'm thinking about it, and it's weird that incompatibilists, or I guess everybody, and to some extent, or allegedly most people, want to believe that free will somehow is outside of causality. But then at the same time, for any given decision, you would want to make the best decision. And what determines the best decision? Well, these factors. I mean, it's like, you know, you recognize fire burns you, you see a fire, you don't touch it. It's like, well, that's pretty causal. I mean, it's weird that, you know, like, so that's, I guess, what I mean when I'm saying I've been a bit confused about how you would define it, because, and maybe that is more of a problem for incompatibilists. It's like trying to define free will in a way that also makes it causal, but not really causal, you know?
Well, no, the compatibilists want it to be causal, right? I meant
incompatibilists. Did I say compatibilists?
Oh, sorry.
I meant to say incompatibilists if I misspoke. Sorry.
So you've got incompatibilists who say that it's causal, but it's not caused by past event. It's caused by an agent, right?
We
are prime movers akin to God. That's what Chisholm says. That's not the only way to think about it. Another way to think about it is, well, it's utterly uncaused, right? That's one position that we can take as an incompatibilist, right? You could say that it has a cause, but it's not deterministic. It's indeterministic. We've got weird quantum indeterminism that's like bubbling up from really basic levels to, you know,
right, but that doesn't offer you any, as has been said numerous times, that doesn't give you more free will somehow, just because there's some random thing happening in your brain or in the world that I don't think anyway.
Well, you know, there is certainly a sense in which the absence of determinism would seem to undermine free will. So you were talking about, you want to make the best choice. So you, let's say you deliberate, right? You consider the important factors, whether to go to Harvard or Yale. And it would be horrifying if there, after all this, you know, deliberation and research and consideration, that instead of you think, okay, I'm going to go to Harvard. That's the place to go, right? Instead of you going to Harvard, you end up choosing a Yale. You'd be like, what the hell just happened, right? Oh, that's indeterminism for you.
Yeah.
Welcome to freedom. No, this would totally suck, right? So, for compatibilists, they're definitely not trying to get out of determinism. They're like, determinism is okay. In fact, we can think of clearly some situations where the lack of determinism would be quite frightening, right? If all of our, again, deliberation, all of our efforts at self-control, the stuff that Namias was talking about as being important for free will, if all that stuff didn't determine our choices and our actions, we would be deeply concerned about that, right? And this is the opposite of what incompatibilists suggest, that once we learn about determinism, that we're freaked out, you know, and we've lost the free will that we deeply value. So yeah, I mean, it can go in different directions. You can determinism, indeterminism, causes, no causes, agent causes, event causes, right? There's a lot of nuance to explore in the debate. I do like that we've got one thing kind of pinned down here, right? That both sides of the debate are making an appeal to ordinary everyday intuitions. And historically, neither side has consulted anybody's intuitions except their own, right?
Yeah.
And only now, you know, starting with the seminal work of Namias back in 2005, do we have people trying to systematically investigate this using the methods of empirical psychology. And Namias' results, and he's not the only one publishing in the field, right? There's some others that are putting out some work there, various other experimental philosophers that are interested in this. I mentioned the Bad Wizards podcast earlier because I was gonna name Tamlin Summers. He's a philosopher that's interested in this stuff, and he put together a really wonderful summary of experimental philosophy and free will in a journal called Philosophy Compass. Usually it's behind a paywall, but I was actually able to access this via Google. So if you want to look into this and your listeners want to look into this, so if you just Google experimental philosophy and free will, a review, let me double check it here. Yeah, the very first result is a PDF at University of Houston where Tamlin Summers teaches. And it's very accessible. It's not like reading the highly technical stuff that you would often encounter in philosophical journals. It's very accessible. Overview of the debate with some discussion, not only of Namias' work, but of other work out there, and some criticisms of the state of research so far, suggesting some open questions, in particular saying that maybe the research so far, in particular Namias's, which suggests the incompatibles have it wrong, maybe this research isn't quite as compelling as it appears. There are some other things that compatibilists like Namias need to work on to really take and put the incompatibles in the ground when it comes to, at the very least, their claims about ordinary everyday intuitions. And it's short, it's like 14 pages. Again, very accessible, an excellent resource to check out on that end. Because I mentioned one scenario in one part of one research paper among maybe 10 or 15 altogether. So we got that out there. and Eddie, because I told him I was going to go on the show, and I was like, hey, man, you know, send me your copy of your review of Sam Harris's Free Will and any other sort of hot stuff that you got going. He's like, well, let me know when the podcast is out. And when he hears this, and he sees that I talked about like barely a sliver of his body of work, you know. I'm going to have to avoid him because I know he's going
to
want
to. You're going to have to think twice about that certificate you're giving me. Be like, man, this guy, you know, just put it all on me. Just blame me.
I think he'll be nonetheless pleased that I got one person on board.
Oh no, yeah, I think from the beginning it's
worthwhile research.
Yeah,
that could play an important role here in advancing the debate. Absolutely. Not intended to settle the question. It's not like let's take a survey and find out what people think.
Right.
Boom, got the problem solved. No, it's not like that. It's more, if you're going to talk about people's intuitions, let's find out what they actually are. Maybe we'll need to revise them, right? Eddie is open to that view that maybe a little bit of revision is required here.
Right.
Again, it depends on what people think in the first place. And philosophers, despite making scientifically investigable, empirical, psychological claims, haven't actually done the science. Right?
And if I was going to do some more of that, some more claim making without, you know, surveying more people, a guess at this whole free will, you know, intuition and, you know, what our views are and what non-philosophers' views are, it seems to me that there – It likely, and maybe the research will bear this out, I don't know, it likely could come from wanting to blame people for things and wanting to feel like they are responsible. And you know, we want to feel like when we accomplish something, we accomplish it. And when others do something wrong, you know, it's their fault somehow.
So the praise and blame stuff and moral responsibility, how does this hook up with our understanding of free will? Well, Namias is looking at this stuff, but what I'm going to do, instead of, you know, Namias, and he'll be disappointed that I didn't lay more Namias on you. I'm going to point to what I think is roughly kind of like not a psychological bit of science, but a sort of informal bit of anthropology that certain incompatibilists have done. Galen Strawson is a philosopher who is an incompatibilist and denies that individuals have ultimate responsibility. And as an incompatibilist, he is assuming that ultimate responsibility is required for free will. And he is among those who claims that people are natural incompatibilists. And here's some evidence that he gives. Now, this is not, you know, empirical psychology. This is not the sort of systematic work that Namias is doing. But it seems to have a strong intuitive appeal to us. He says, when I talk about ultimate responsibility, says Galen Strawson, and he makes an argument that works with that whole transfer of non-responsibility principle. Mm-hmm. He says, it's called the basic argument. That's how fundamental and badass this argument is, man. This is where it begins for incompatibilists in his view, the basic argument. And it just comes down to the past and laws of nature is not up to you, right? So what's happening now is not up to you. Transfer of non-responsibility, lack of ultimate responsibility. He says, when I'm talking about ultimate responsibility, this is what I mean, the sort of responsibility that would justify someone burning in hell forever. And, well, what do we find? We find apparently a rather widespread belief in hell, where you are going to be punished forever.
I was going to bring that up earlier. I think that actually was kind of where I was going with that. But sorry, I'll let you continue.
All right. So this... Dude, this actually sounds pretty compelling.
Right. When you're taking a survey of what people think, and throughout history, we've all thought that people were deserving of punishment. So that would suggest, man, I'm kicking myself that I didn't say that. I should have written it down. I actually was thinking that, and I said the other thing, you know, about the why would there be a free will debate? The other thing I was going to say was, you know, historically, people have been quite okay with blaming people for their actions.
Yeah. And, you know, you might say, well, look, we can have blame, you know, without getting too carried away here with this ultimate responsibility stuff, you know.
But not that kind of blame.
Not
the eternal hell kind of blame. I think regardless of what side you're on, I mean, that's anything more than like a corrective kind of blame, you know, like a punishment that's going to correct future, you know, if, actions, anything more than that seems completely incompatible with either side of the debate to me. I think that's the main thing to get from this.
So retribution is not forward looking, man. It's not like you're going to be
exactly
by burning in hell forever. No, you're just going to burn in hell forever. That's the end of the story, man. Well, the unending story, as it turns out. This could be taken as sort of an informal anthropological inquiry. Right, we look across history, we find the prevalence of this belief in hell, and you say, "Well, what would justify people thinking that if they also thought that we were ultimately responsible for our actions?" That would explain. That would be the best explanation available for this widespread belief in everlasting, ultimate, burn it up, maggots eating you, like retribution. Right. So that's there.
Right, that makes total sense as an argument that people, like you said, you're sort of reverse engineering what the popular conception might be because of that.
Indeed, but we would still need to take and reconcile the results of this sort of kind of informal anthropological inquiry with the more formal, rigorous, systematic psychological inquiries.
My suspicion is that it's just laziness of thinking that leads to this. they might hold both views, really, and just not really realize it.
I was looking up Jerry Coyne for something today, man, and I was reading about his position on not the incompatibility of free will and determinism, but of science and religion. And he was saying, when we find scientists who are religious, all this proves is that individuals can hold two contradictory ideas in their head at the same time, right? Not that science and religion are somehow compatible because there are scientists who are also religious. And what we could find here, I think this is kind of what you were saying along the same lines, is people have this notion of everlasting retribution in their head. But this just could be, again, the result of sloppy thinking.
And to butt in real quick, that and maybe almost just a utilitarian kind of, like, it works throughout evolutionary history to have this idea.
Okay. Well, because when you talk about utilitarianism, we're talking about...
Sorry, I probably used the wrong word, but just this, the utility of the belief. Like, the belief is not maybe accurate, but it works throughout history for animals like us to kind of blame each other for things. It creates a better, so maybe in an idea that is a result of evolution possibly. Not something that's coherent with like the rest of our beliefs necessarily.
Yeah. No, that's what Dennett says, right? Okay, explanation that he's given for belief in the existence of God as like a lawgiver and a one who doles out punishment and reward is this is something that it encourages honest dealing, right? So these two people, right, if there's no sort of like, I could just deceive you and run off with your donkey or whatever people stole from one another back in the day when they lived in huts. If without this, eye in the sky, ready to punish the evildoers, right, we might have had less cooperation and trust. So this particular illusion of a lawgiver and punisher, Dennett thinks that that's something that emerged to encourage honest dealing, right? And that's why the idea survived, is because honest dealing, cooperation like that better promoted our fitness. But setting that evolutionary explanation aside for how the notion of God emerged, I want to make sure that we recognize that there's a difference between a consequentialist. Utilitarianism would be a version of consequentialism and, moral philosophical debates. There's a difference between a consequentialist justification for punishment and a merit-based one, right? So when we talk about, for instance, the death penalty as a deterrent, we're saying that showing that we will kill people who kill others creates a disincentive, right, for that sort of behavior among, potential murderers, right? We are justifying it based on its consequences. But we can also justify the death penalty not merely as a deterrent, not merely as something that potentially reduces the number of murders out there. But we could justify it on a retribution, a retributive sort of basis. And that's not forward-looking, right? You kill that person, you're not going to reform them. They're just dead. And the belief is that they are deserving of this punishment, based on the crime that they committed. So that's the merit-based stuff that would motivate retributive punishment and a retributive justification of the death penalty, for instance. On the other hand, you've got the forward-looking consequentialist one, and that's the one that compatibilists favor, right? They think that when it comes to this notion of desert, right? It's not some deep retributive one, right? It's something that's more based on consequences. But, I believe that they still, this is something I'm trying to clear up myself. I believe that compatibilists still want to have some notion of merit involved, but it's definitely not the sort of stuff that incompatibilists think is part of the ordinary conception of free will, where this could, in the extreme, be the sort of merit or desert, deservedness for, burning in hell forever.
Yeah,
but I thought it was important, right, to show that on the other side, while they haven't done the systematic work, the incompatibilist side, they haven't historically done the sort of systematic work that Namias and compatibilists are trying to do now, at least the X-Fi ones, experimental philosophy guys. There have been some appeals, and with Harris as well, right? he and various others, when they point to the experience of conscious willing, they are trying to provide some empirical evidence themselves. It's not the sort of
ranging. Yeah, usually first person kind of.
Yeah. Yeah. They just say, you know, consult your experience there, right? Yeah. That's sort of introspective method. But that's not the the best.
Yeah, I think
Wegner gets us closer with his investigation into conscious willing.
Absolutely, and I'm very curious to hear more about Namias's experiments if they continue, and I might have, like you said, you only reference one part of one, and everyone can go ahead and look out, do the research, and look at more of those. I'll look them up too. Well, I've kept you way longer than you said you'd stay. I didn't mean to. Don't hold me accountable for this. I was, you know, determined to do it.
It's perfectly all right. I guess when I thought, I was like, we just can't stop it here.
I know. That's what I always think. We can't stop it anywhere. But especially with Mr. Ryan Bourne, it never goes anywhere that's not interesting. Thank you so much. There's much more to talk about. I don't know. We'll have to find outline the next time I can have you on, you know, whether it be a continuation of one of these things or a different topic, because it's great. I always learn a lot.
Well, I'm glad to be on the show with you. I think this is wonderful. I think that public philosophy is very important. You know, it's one thing to just go and kind of have exchanges and journal articles and conferences and stuff. It's another to go out there, particularly on these sort of things that really matter to individuals. And it's a hot topic. Right, yeah. You said dark. It's hot, man. While we're not going to solve the problem, clearly, we can take and try and think and speak clearly about it. And while there's much more that could have been said and we didn't get to, I would encourage you and your listeners to check out the Tamlin Summers Summary of Experimental Philosophy and Free Will. That's excellent. You can also visit Eddie Namias' faculty page over at Georgia State University. He's posted a lot of his papers.
I will try to get those links in the notes too.
Yeah, and while those are journal articles, they're still pretty accessible, right? He always begins with some discussion of basic terms. There are some sections of it that are going to be difficult to understand by most individuals just because it's experimental psychology and they have a lot of stats. I don't even understand that stuff here. But they do have excellent summaries of the results, which are very easy to understand. It's very easy to understand their discussion and conclusion. So it's really good stuff to take a look at, and it's not something that was really coming out in more popular discussions of this topic by scientists, right? The most visible advocates of any position in the free will debate, it seems they tend to be scientists, right? And I want folks to know that, well, actually there are philosophers who are doing some science that the scientists aren't even doing that is relevant to the debate and that they ought to check out.
Absolutely. All right, Ryan Bourne, pleasure as always. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Talk to you soon. Another week gone by of episodes and another chance to thank my glorious patrons, without whom this show would just not exist anymore. Because it's just quite simply too much work to do for free. But I digress. One new patron this week, Emily, thank you so much for signing on. I encourage others to please do so at patreon.com/atheist. And of course, I got to thank my all-time greats. They are, of course, Jonathan Moyer, Havard S., John P., Bangs Naughty Bits, Jiro, 1369, Dale, Cincy Farmer, Jeremy Sharp, Jim, Matt, and Matt Garrett. Thank you so much. As always, you're the best, and I hope you're enjoying the tons of bonus content I've put out over the course of the last several months, and of course the early episodes. So thank you guys, and I will see you next week.
The first taste of rare bourbon you finally got your hands on. That's nice. At Caskers.com, we make this experience easy. Caskers is a one-stop spirit curator with an impressive selection of exclusive, sought-after, rare, and household names in the realm of premium spirits and champagne. Discover the top flavors of the year now by going to Caskers.com and using code WELCOME10 for $10 off your first purchase. Get $10 off your first purchase with code WELCOME10 at Caskers.com.